Chris White joins me this week to discuss the yeast life cycle and fermentation. This is Beersmith Podcast number 190.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 190, and it's mid-April 2019. Chris White joins me to discuss the yeast life cycle. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're currently offering a 20% discount to all listeners for their all-access subscription pass, with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. And also the Riptide Pump from Blickman Engineering. Designed for homebrewers, this pump features a whisper quiet sealed housing, a removable tri-clamp stainless steel head that's easy to clean, and a built-in relief valve for easy priming. It also has the integral Blickman linear valve for precise flow control. Get the Riptide Pump today. Another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith 3 is now available for download, and also the mobile version's out. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider recipe support to the Beersmith platform, along with new integrated water profile and mash pH tools. Dozens of new features, including cloud folders, updated databases, support for fruit juice and honey, as well as new Whirlpool hop options. Download your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com and give it a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome Dr. Chris White. Chris is the president of White Labs, Inc., a top provider of brewing yeast worldwide, as well as a 2015 winner of the AHA Governing Committee Award for Lifetime Achievement in Brewing. He's also the author of the book Yeast, which is the Bible for brewing yeast. Chris, it's always great to have you back on the show.
It's awesome to be here. Thanks, Brad.
I like your picture of Abe Lincoln there in the back. Very inspiring.
It's my office here in San Diego. It was a big space, so I found a big personality to put it there.
There you go. So it's great to have you back. What have you been up to lately, Chris, since the last had you on the show?
Well, I've just been working with White Labs and doing the thing I do every day, trying to make better yeast and then more of it available. We've got a great team here in our different facilities. I was in Asheville, North Carolina a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, I was there with you, I think.
Yeah, you sure were. And so that was a fun BYO boot camp. And then we had the Craft Brewers Conference last week in Denver, Colorado. That's the biggest trade show we do. 10,000 people again. Denver, the city was a great host. I think it was one of the best conferences in a while. All the brewers that go there, many of them are paying their own way. I mean, you don't see that in many trade shows, right? That people care that much about their industry. They pay their own way. They take classes. They go to the education. They go to the trade show in mass. You know, they don't stay away from the trade show and just go party. They do that later. It's an amazing energy. The whole energy of the craft brewing industry is brought into the Craft Brewers Conference.
And you mentioned, I think you mentioned me some time ago that craft beer is the majority of your business now, right?
Yeah, it's the majority of our business now. We started with home brewing, that's how we started. I started as a home brewer, but within months, I was selling yeast to commercial breweries after starting White Labs, and it's continued to grow just over 24 years at a faster pace. And then with we make a lot more yeast now for commercial breweries and other commercial applications like wine and spirits and things. But home brewing is still important to us and that whole hobby culture. So we make about 70 strains a week, which is a task to have that many different types of strains being made and put in little homebrew packages. But we do it every week because we really care.
And as I saw, you brew beer now, too, out of the two locations, right?
Yeah, we have a breweries in three locations, White Labs in San Diego, White Labs in Asheville, North Carolina, and White Labs Copenhagen is also a brewery. Even though we're mostly making yeast in those facilities, we also have the ability to brew beer and sell beer, and it helps showcase what yeast does. And everybody working here likes beer, so it kind of works with that as well. And in Asheville, we also added the restaurant that you went to, so we can kind of experiment more with food cultures and bacteria, yeast and bacteria cultures of food, have wine, have spirits. And
yeah, I encourage folks, if you get a chance to go to any of those locations, they serve the beer, but they'll serve like a beer made with one wort with several different yeast strains, right?
Right. So we split a beer into usually two fermenters, same batch, into two smaller fermenters from the brew house, and pitch two different yeast strains. And it could be an IPA with a California ale yeast and then a Belgian strain, something like that. We have a brewed IPA on right now that has California ale yeast and WLP590, the French Saison yeast. Which is already known as a dry yeast, STA positive, but then brewed, of course, is dry anyway, and you get the phenols with the 590, but it's a light phenol strain, so that's a really fun combination, and it fits with what's topical with brewed IPAs at the moment. So we get to brew whatever's kind of new, using our portfolio of yeast strains or new ones we have in development.
Yeah, it was educational for me to see how different one beer could be with just two different yeast strains just by changing the yeast strain. So I enjoyed that.
Yeah, and you're an experienced brewer, and so imagine the people just off the street that are kind of maybe beer fans, maybe not. It can just blow them away, and that's fun to see.
Yeah. Well, today we wanted to discuss the yeast life cycle and fermentation. So let's start with yeast preparation. What do you recommend when we're working with liquid yeast packets? Are you a big starter guy, or what do you recommend?
Well, I really feel there's kind of three main pillars to yeast preparation and handling. And pitching is one of them. Aeration is another one. And then nutrients is a third. So those are, I think they're all sort of equal. I think people tend to focus on pitching mostly because that's what they can measure. But those other two parameters are just as important. So whether you make a starter or not isn't going to make a huge difference. It's not that it's not a bad idea. And for certain styles and for certain things, or you want a certain pitching, you want a certain speed, all that's okay. But the main thing is to be in that millions of cells per mil range, which you get with pretty much any yeast on the market in 20 liters. The distillers and winemakers are at the kind of bottom of that, one or two or so million cells per mil total, where brewers tend to want to be that million cells per mil, particularly Plato. And that's often when repitching, that's what it was originally designed for, because that's what brewers did. So you'd be at the 10 to 15 million cells per mil. So people make starters, some people don't make starters. If the oxygen is correct, the nutrients are correct in that range, you still get the same final gravity. That's what's key.
Right. Well, let's talk for a minute about dry yeast. Is a process, liquid yeast fairly easy. You just pitch it, right? But dry yeast, maybe a little more preparation.
So traditionally, yeah, dry yeast, you would rehydrate. And that's been the instructions from the beginning with beer, because the flavor is so essential in beer. And this comes back to that pitching rate again. Like, you can add as much yeast as you want, but it's still got to grow. So every batch of beer, the yeast grows, no matter if you add a lot or a little. So it's not like what you're putting in is the flavor, right? The flavor comes from the growth. So the yeast have to grow, and the yeast make the flavors that are so important in beer. So that's why brewers, even when they use dry yeast, you want to be really careful in the handling it and rehydrating it. Now, there are recommendations to not rehydrate. And from my side, I feel that that's from just making it easy to use, right? It's always been my impression from the beginning that that's sort of just a way of, say, making it easier to use. Is that the best for the beer? We've done a lot of experiments, and I always feel the flavors are better when rehydrating. I still feel that way, but open to new ideas.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of people saying just sprinkle the yeast on the top, but I like you, I'm a big fan of hydrating it, particularly as you start to get into the high gravity beers and you start to worry about some of the bad things that can happen pitching dry yeast in a high gravity, you know?
Yeah, because cells are all membranes, right? So cells are just all membranes. What's around the cells, lipid membranes, what's around all the organelles. And so that's a very complex structure that needs to be reformed right. You know, this dry crumpled strain is going to grab liquid again, but the membranes have to get in the right orientation to do the important export of flavors like esters and other things that they do, and viability, high alcohol beers. It's really important that the unsaturated fatty acids and sterols get in the right reorientation. So if you don't rehydrate, I feel you never give them the chance to get in that right position, even when they, you know, even if you start collecting and reusing, the viability what we have measured is still lower. Nothing has changed in that, you know, in the drying process that a little tweaks in here and there, but not some new technology that has said, that has changed that, in my opinion. But that's the beauty of this industry and this whole homebrewing hobby. Everything industrially can be done at home in 20 liters. That's how we all learn to make beer, whether we're in the industry or not. And this is one of those great examples. Just do it, you know? And I would be, you know, every time we've done it, the rehydrated is better.
Yeah, I think the problem is the dry yeast doesn't have, as you mentioned, the structure in place to regulate the cell walls, right? Potentially, right, when you first pitch it. So if you hydrate it first, you're giving it that opportunity for the cell wall to act like it's supposed to, right?
Yeah. And I guess the cool thing is, for those that don't want to do it, it obviously works good enough because a lot of people are not rehydrating. So it's not a big spillage of nasty flavors. As it might have used to. So I think, you know, we're talking about small differences, but that's where homebrewers love to get in the weeds of the small differences to try to make the best beer possible.
Well, let's walk through the yeast life cycle. What happens, for example, whether it's liquid or dry yeast, what happens when we first pitch that yeast into the wort?
So what I think a lot of brewers would love is they pitch the yeast into the wort and they see bubbles coming out, right? With CCO2, job's done, beer's fermenting. But that means it's growing. And you gotta give it a few minutes because the yeast, what they're doing, that lag phase is important. They're accumulating these nutrients. We're talking, all these nutrients I'm talking about that are so important, oxygen, zinc, those things that are gonna allow them to grow well, they gotta take up, and it takes a few hours. So
talk about that first phase. You said it's a lag phase, I think you called it.
Yeah. So lag phase, you want from 5 to 15 hours. Once in a while it can be a little shorter, but 5 to 15 hours is kind of a normal lag phase. And if it goes too long over that, say you're not in the millions of cells per mil range when you pitch, you know, then it's too long and some other organisms could start to compete for the yeast. But the 5 to 15 hours is good. The yeast is accumulating, it's taking in the oxygen. It's not using it yet. It'll use it later, as we'll talk about, but it's taking it in. Yeast absorb all of these things in competition with the mass of cells that are there, the yeast cells. So if there's not enough nutrients for all the cells, yeah, they'll start fermenting fast, but that's not ideal. When the yeast start fermenting, you see CO2. Because CO2 is made with ethanol. So as the yeast start to make the ethanol in the anaerobic fermentation, they'll make the CO2. The brewer sees the CO2, but that CO2 means they're in the log phase of growth, in the fermentation phase. So in the lag phase, you don't want to see gas yet.
So obviously oxygen is very important in this phase, right?
It's important. It's not used yet. But the some people feel like, or the misinformation a little bit is maybe in the lag phase, yeast is doing aerobic fermentation or something. No. They never really do aerobic fermentation. They take up the oxygen, not for aerobic fermentation, but to later make the lipids that I was just talking about are so important for the membranes.
Those are those, I've heard the word sterols too, is that right?
Yeah. Sterols, yeah. And unsaturated fatty acids.
Okay, so this lag phase continues for some time. Oh, one more thing I want to ask you about it, because I think we talked about this once. If you're working with high gravity beers, do you actually need more oxygen?
You need a lot more oxygen.
A lot more oxygen, okay.
A lot more oxygen. The solubility of oxygen in wort is a lot more difficult, at higher gravities. So the hard part with oxygen is, you know, you're giving the oxygen before the lag phase, right? As you're pitching the yeast or before you pitch the yeast. So you're putting the oxygen in from the gas into the liquid. So it actually has to change phases, right? You don't want to just add oxygen gas into your wort and let it come out. That did you no good.
Right.
You patiently have to add the oxygen at the right, you know, flow rate and temperature, because lower temperatures helps the solubility of changing the gas to a liquid. And then, so you're trying to get that 8 to 10 ppm of dissolved oxygen in the wort. So then when you add the yeast, all those cells take it up as equally as possible to use later. So if you end up with 5 ppm, about half of normal, which then the cells won't grow as well, because they won't make as many lipids.
And you mentioned when you get to the higher gravity, it's much harder to get that level of oxygen in, I guess?
Right. So if you're at 12 Plato, and you're in 20 liters, 1 or 2 minutes of oxygen, pure oxygen, you know, at 68 degrees, that's going to give you close to 5 to 8, you know, to 10 ppm. Sorry, 8 to 10 ppm, not 5. If you're 18 to 20 degrees of Plato,
yeah.
You know, you might be at 5 with that same amount of oxygen. So the difference, now you're, instead of being at 10, you're at 5, even if you go longer periods of time. So, you know, you can dissolve, you can get a little more solubility by going to a lower temperature and more time.
Yep. Is there another trick we talked about at one time? I think I talked probably with you, but was, can you put oxygen in more than once?
Yes. Not a lot of experiments on it, because brewers are typically very afraid to add anything post fermentation, post inoculation. Post
pitching, yeah.
Right. Where every other industry that uses yeast, pretty much every fermenter is built for multiple additions, whatever it might be, and mixing. But brewers, we don't want to introduce contamination. We don't want to introduce oxygen for oxidation. Very valid reason. But that's also a challenge. So what a lot of home brewers have noticed is, hey, if I add more oxygen in 12 hours, it works better. And it's almost like, well, of course it does, especially with high gravity beers. Because often we're not getting the optimum oxygen in the first place. But as the yeast is growing, and if they're starving, as they double, and the double, you know, you get about fivefold growth, each time you need to double the amount of lipids. So if you're oxygen starved at all, it's going to, or if you can pump up the oxygen a little bit to make more sterols, then you're going to see a better fermentation. Hmm. And if you don't get oxidation from it, there's really no harm in adding oxygen later in little bits. If it doesn't oxidize your beer, it's only going to benefit the yeast.
Yeah, I've actually done this with wines and meads. I haven't done it with a lot of high gravity beers, but it seems to work very, very well. It gives you a little extra boost, I guess. Adding that additional oxygen at 12 hours.
So. Yeah, especially on those high gravity beers, and a lot of beers home brewers and commercial brewers are making are high gravity beers.
Oh yeah.
And if you don't give that extra oxygen, you can end up with something very estery. That's one of the dangers of not having the right oxygen level. Not only do they not finish out, leaving a sweeter beer, they're also more fruity than they should be. And that's involving those ester pathways. So that increased oxygen lowers the esters and gives the right final gravity to not have an overly sweet beer. So on a high gravity beer, that little extra shot of oxygen is a really nice thing to do. And it should be talked about a lot. But we, as we talked about at the beginning of this interview, it's pitching rate, let's talk a lot about, because it's something you can sort of physically measure. Oh, I'll add more of this. But actually, oxygen is directly related, the same. If you look at charts of growth rates of pitching versus oxygen, they're the same. The more oxygen, the faster the fermentation.
Awesome. Well, after the end of this lag phase, we then enter the phase of rapid growth, which is where most of the fermentation what we think is fermentation takes place, right?
That's where the flavors happen.
So can you describe that phase and what's going on and what are some of the things happening?
So at that point, it's not a transition from an aerobic fermentation to an anaerobic fermentation. That's just what that's the terminology a lot of people use, but it's not really the case. The yeast has finished the lag phase. They've accumulated these nutrients. They start using the oxygen to make lipids because the oxygen is needed for that. So not this aerobic respiration part that really doesn't happen much at all because of the high wort concentration, high sugar concentrations, Crabtree. So they kind of just go from lag to fermentation, anaerobic fermentation. So they're using that oxygen to make the unsaturated fatty acids, part of the lipids, and the sterols. That helps make the membranes. So each cell's now got to duplicate its nucleus, all the other organelles, the DNA, make new daughter cells, which are clones of themselves. Pretty cool, barring a few little mutations that happen here or there. But they start growing. So as they're growing, what are they doing? They're taking in the wort sugars, glucose, fructose, sucrose, maltose, and finally maltotriose. Maltose being the most prevalent carbohydrate, but they take them in that certain order. So they start taking in these carbohydrates and then making ethanol and CO2. But nothing happens in a direct line inside of a cell. It doesn't go from enzyme to enzyme to enzyme to enzyme. It does if it finds those enzymes, but it finds another enzyme floating around. It goes into amino acid metabolism, that piece of material, or lipid metabolism, or some other kind of acid. And so then you end up with something different. So that's where all these little flavor and aroma compounds come from.
These are some of the things we may call off flavors, possibly?
They can be off flavors. They can be good flavors.
Yeah.
that's the challenge of this biological fermentation happening. You know, the brewer's trying to do all they can to kind of control it with temperature and oxygen, all the stuff. But at the end of the day, it's going to be this biological fermentation that's just life is transforming in front of you. And it's hopefully going to make something that tastes good. But every cell is going to find a little bit of different nutrition. And they're going to grow a little differently. So it's amazing that it works as good as it does, but that goes back to the traditional like techniques brewers have put around this fermentation procedure. So for the most part, all they can do is sit back and watch this log phase of growth happen, where the fermentation's happening, where the flavors are happening. But you've done everything you could by that point, put enough yeast in there, you've added the right amount of oxygen, hopefully the zinc is right. You set the temperature correctly, and hopefully it maintains it really well. And then you just kind of sit back and you say, gosh, I hope that fermentation goes well. And when it comes out of this rapid growth phase, then you can taste it and see if it's – and usually it's great.
One of the things I want to talk about, though, obviously some yeasts have produced different kinds of off flavors or different levels of off flavors, like, you know, Belgians, for example, a lot of Belgian yeast produce a lot of phenolics. What's going on there? What's happening there? Why do the yeast have such an impact?
Yeah. I mean, yeast make this tremendous range of compounds because basically humans selected the strains that tasted good time after time after time after time, thousands of years, especially the last hundreds of years. So we've got these yeast strains that make esters, you know, make fruitiness. It's pretty crazy. We've got yeast.
The British yeast, right, are all estery, right? Many of them are.
And then these strains that make phenols, these phenol-positive strains, we call them POF-positive, phenolic off-flavor positive. And then it's phenolic off-flavor negative, like the British strains and lager strains and stuff. But the ones that are phenolic, they're just closer to wild. Now, they have a bunch of Saccharomyces cerevisiae brewer's yeast in there, but if they make phenols, they're closer to wild strains because every strain in the wild makes phenols. They couldn't live in the wild without making phenols. It's part of the pathway of detoxifying compounds from plants. So if yeast is going to be in the wild, it's probably going to find itself on a plant at some point and need to live. So detoxifying these materials resulting in phenols is a part of that natural biochemistry. So brewers have kind of mutated by selecting brewer's yeast away from making phenols in because we wanted good flavored beers. We don't want beers with phenols, but it's a little bit mean to the yeast because if they ever got back in the wild, they'd die. So the phenolic positive ones are almost everything. If you collect yeast in your backyard and you say, I want to make a beer out of this, is it going to be good? Sure. Or your beard? Sure. But it's going to be phenolic. And then most people just describe that as Belgian-like.
Interesting. So any of the other flavors you want to talk about? You talked a little bit about esters, but...
Sulfur, the lager strains make sulfur compounds, which freak out people usually for the first time when they make lager beers.
Rotten eggs, right?
Yeah. Jamil's line in our book was, who farted?
Yeah.
Nice. He's a funny guy. But it's a nice kind of wake-up thing to like, oh, yeah, this is doing something different. Why is this doing something different? Well, Saccharomyces pastureanus is a different species. In fact, it's the only species decision brewers make when they make beer. It's like Saccharomyces cerevisiae ale, Saccharomyces pastureanus lager. And Saccharomyces pastureanus lager makes more sulfur compounds. And that's pretty normal, and that's become a flavor signature of lagers. There'd be a lot more sulfur in those beers, except for the lagering process, which the Germans thought were really important. You know, so they would lager the beer for months to reduce the sulfur and the diacetyl. And that's why lager beer today doesn't have as much sulfur as it, you get like when you're at the end of fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty volatile, so.
We talked a little about the environment, the nutrients that you put in, a lot of stuff's all determined up front, but, what about temperature? How does temperature affect, probably one of the only things you can control while fermentation's going on, right? How does that affect things?
Exactly. That's another one of those things brewers have control over, so they can dial it in great. It's not super easy on the home level because it's just now we're getting some really good tools, but just now, you know, I mean, the temperature control was great on brewery fermenters when I started, you know, in this industry, but it really has taken a while to get to the home level because cooling is what's difficult, right? Heating things, real simple. We don't want to be heating our fermenters. We're usually trying to cool them. And we're usually trying to cool them to 68 degrees Fahrenheit for ales, you know, about 1920°C. Mm-hmm. And why that temperature? It's not because yeast like that temperature. It's cold to a yeast strain still, right? Yeast cells are tiny, microscopic, microbiology, right? So they boast microbes like high temperatures, at least 90 Fahrenheit, about 30°C. So 68 is already cold. But it was a common temperature in Northern Europe as these British styles were being honed in. So, you know, before temperature control. So strains were selected that fermented well at that temperature, but it's still cold. Now, then you had the lager strains developed, you know, in Bavaria, Bohemia, that were fermenting at 50, 55, you know, 10, 13°C. That's really, really cold. That's Arctic conditions to a yeast cell.
Mm-hmm.
That's why no other microbes survive at those temperatures. So very few do, right? It's a hostile environment. But these lager strains ferment slowly. That's why you can overcome that a bit with higher amounts. But they ferment slowly at those temperatures. But those are the two ranges we're kind of in. And the better you keep them in those ranges, the better the flavors are going to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I started homebrewing, I fermented at home. Fortunately, I was in San Diego, the closest to the mid-70s in the United States, Fahrenheit, but that's still pretty warm. And beers were okay, and you cover it with a towel, and then you get a fridge, and you put it in the fridge, and it's okay, but that's a lot of cooling power and a little bit of liquid. So what really is coming out now is more of the glycol, thin layers of glycol around a big volume of liquid, precision control. I think that's a great thing that's happening for homebrew. And you're then able to replicate the real fermentation flavors in a commercial brewery. Mm-hmm.
Well, after high krausen, the yeast enters another phase. That's the beginning of maturation. What's going on in this phase?
So we call that stationary phase. Uh-huh. Now, it used to be called death phase. I mean, I've seen that in some literature. And I don't think that's fair because you don't want your yeast dying. You know, in fermentation, we want our yeast living after fermentation because it also destroys our flavor. So after that high krausen, okay, all that CO2 has been made. It starts slowing down. You see that. What's happening inside the liquid is the yeast cell knows it's slowing down too. Just through these biological adaptations that have been developed, the cell knows when the sugar is almost gone because there's less receptors full of sugar. So they don't just consume all the sugar and then they would die. But what they do is they take those last remnants of sugar in the stationary phase and convert it to glycogen. Mm-hmm. Glycogen is their fat, basically. I mean, humans store glycogen too, but we store most of our carbohydrates as fat for someday using if we ever exercise. But yeast don't have the ability to form fats. That's where you can squeeze a whole bunch of carbohydrates in a very small volume. So what they do is they store it as glycogen, which is just kind of a long chain of carbohydrates, very easy to break down again. So it doesn't take a lot of exercise to break down glycogen. In fact, if you just show yeast a little bit of oxygen, they'll start breaking down their glycogen. I think it's time to grow. So anyway, they store that carbohydrate. That's going to be important for the viability to be high if a brewer wants to collect the yeast later. Mm-hmm. So I kind of think of it as a starvation phase, even though it's called stationary phase. For me, it's starvation because that's what the cell is doing. They're noticing the sugar is gone from a biochemical aspect. So these different genetic pathways are turned on to store the glycogen and to trigger flocculation because that's a protein kind of carbohydrate interaction mediated by calcium.
Which is interesting. So the flocculation is actually a phase of the yeast. It's not just the yeast naturally falling out, I guess?
Right. That'd be gravity, and it does actually take effect eventually on a microbe. But you can see some of the wild variants, how long they take to go from cloudy to clear. Brewer's yeast is actively clumping together because of selection, changing genetics in the domestication process. We have these yeast strains that express things on their cell surface that make them stick together, mediated by calcium again. So, and that's usually triggered by starvation. So that turns on these genes for flocculation. There's a few yeasts like our WLP002 English ale yeast and 005, maybe in a couple others, 007. But the English ale yeast is really known for it's very clumpy. It's clumpy inside the yeast package. So it never needs really starvation, you know. But that's abnormality of a cell or whatever. I mean, it's a highly mutated cell, but it's stable. So that's a nice thing about that. But most yeast require that starvation step. Some don't care about starvation and just never flocculate, like the more wild strains. So your phenolic positive strains tend to be less flocculent because they've been less cared for by brewers over these years. Hmm.
So are there other biotransformations going on during this phase as well? I've heard that it doesn't just all stop when the CO2 stops bubbling, right?
Oh, yeah, right. So there's metabolism still to do. There's acetaldehyde in solution, that kind of green beer, green apple. There's a reason they call it the same thing, that needs to be turned into ethanol, which, again, that enzyme, sometimes that acetaldehyde is going to take some time to find that enzyme to get it turned into ethanol. And again, there's also got to be zinc inside the yeast cell at that late stage to make sure you get the right amount of ethanol and then export it. So there's that cleanup. That's a very important cleanup. sulfur, of course, and diacetyl. There's on dry hop beers, there's those biotransformations that's happening with yeast cells and hop components turning into esters, basically, nibbling those bits into esters and changing some of the fruitiness of a beer. That's why if you dry hop earlier, while there's still more active yeast, you'll have more, the higher volume of biotransformation. That's why with the hazy beers, people are dry hopping in the first couple of days to take advantage of that really high yeast activity. But in a stationary phase, that's still happening, just at a lower rate. So basically, you don't, as a brewer, want to lower that temperature from those two temperatures I talked about, really, that you're either at ale or lager temperatures, until you're happy with the conditioning. Because once you cool it beyond what you're already at, any of those chemical reactions and biochemical reactions that we've talked about will be extremely slow.
Interesting. So you don't want to cold crash your beer right after the bubbler stops, huh?
No.
Yeah.
No. Give it that time to condition. And then when you're happy with it, as well as you can be with figuring out how it tastes with the yeast still in there and everything, then cool it.
And as you mentioned, the yeast flocculates out. What do we do? What if we want to reuse the yeast slurry at some point? How do we handle that?
Ideally, with the yeast is settled, whether that's a day or two after the fermentation, or some pretty quickly, you want to remove the beer. I don't mean cool the beer, but you might want to transfer it because there's still yeast in solution that is conditioning the beer sometimes. But the yeast under the beer has already dropped out of phase there, right? So it's not doing the conditioning. And so you take that and ideally you just put it into another beer at the right cell count, to not use all of that volume, because if it grew fivefold, now you've got too much yeast to use in the next beer, ideally. So typically, in the older days, in the British beers and things, it was just in the first couple of days of fermentation, it was skimmed off the top.
Interesting.
Homebrewers could still do that now. I'm surprised it doesn't happen more. I mean, you've got yeast in great condition on the surface of the beer. It's just you got to watch the sanitation real carefully.
So that's I think they call it the Burton method, right? Where they used to take the yeast right off the top of the fermenters, I think, open fermenters.
The Burton Union method was just what was developed in Burton, but throughout the history, especially in the 19th century, as brewers were developing different methods, as science and engineering things were coming into fruition, each brewery was developing different ways of collecting the yeast. It was like these major projects. And so the breweries around Burton worked together, so they developed their method. The breweries around London had their own methods, which were more like drop vessels, they called them. And in the north, they had different methods, which was more those Yorkshire, more squatty tanks. And so the Burton Union system is fun. It's just because it used wooden barrels, and it used, nobody had to physically go in there and scrape the yeast off. They focused on pushing the yeast out of the barrel, out and up into a trough above the barrels, and then the trough is where the yeast would settle out, and they would take that and use it for repitching beers.
Right. So that's similar to what you were describing, where you're taking the yeast off the top, I guess, right?
Yeah. Works good, and there's less hot material on the surface than when you wait till at the end. There's less true. Yeah. The yeast is in much higher viability. Something to think about.
Yeah. A lot of the off flavors come from the fermentation process. What are some of the steps that an average home brewer can take to improve their fermentation and reduce those off flavors?
Sanitation. And that is a big one, right? And unless you're a microbiologist, it's a little hard to understand what sanitation means. Because microbiological sanitation is what would be done in a hospital.
I think they call it sterilization, right? Would be sort of what you might do in a hospital, an autoclave or something.
That's the highest end. But very few things are still sterilized in a hospital. But yeah,
pretty extreme.
But sterile is no living things.
Yeah.
Everything else on the aseptic process, coming to that, is on the way to sterile. And it's about how well your hands work. how good the surface is. Is there a draft? Are what I see in most folks is they don't understand the need to cover things up. Mm-hmm. This goes back to what Louis Pasteur recognized, that it was yeast in the air that was causing, you know, contaminations and things like that. So that's why his whole swan neck flask worked. But yet today, in a lot of our homebrewing, we're not taking advantage of that knowledge. We're leaving the opening of a fermenter sitting there after we put the cold wort in, and well, someday we'll add the yeast. No, you got to cover that with some foil. Think about covering anything that's, once you're on the cold side or you've sanitized it, with some good clean foil. That's really good practices. And then making sure that the hoses are well cleaned.
And they're hard to get clean too.
They're hard to clean.
Yeah.
So this is, you have to actively clean to be good at cleaning and sanitation for the quality of beer that's needed, because it's a microbiology process. And I know a lot of people don't like that part, but that's really essential. And all the good brewers have that. They just know it. Everybody I've brewed with, from Jamil to, you know, Youssef Chenet, my early homebrew partner who became big in San Diego, you know, they actively learned it. They knew it was important. So that, I can't talk about yeast without talking about how important that is. And then pitching the right amount of good yeast, of course, is great. Making sure the oxygen is, you know, at 10, as close to 10 ppm as possible. Mm-hmm. Making sure you have the right amount of nutrients. Someday, that's a harder thing to measure, but zinc is so critical, especially for high gravity beers and lagers too. And then if you can control the fermentation temperature like commercial breweries do, giving it the right conditioning time, which most homebrewers already do, I think that's the one aspect of homebrewing versus commercial brewing that homebrewers have well above the competition or the commercial side, is their patient. They condition pretty well because they don't have the, like, oh, I got to empty this fermenter tomorrow because I got to brew again. So commercial breweries are, you know, a lot of pressure to ferment faster.
Yeah. You got any tricks for people who want to mature their beer a little bit quicker?
Fermenting under pressure, as we talked about a little bit, is a really good way.
Yeah, we covered that in the last podcast with John Blickman, the last one you were in with John Blickman. I can't remember the episode number, but you can look it up.
Yeah, and it's we've continued to do some experiments, and John and I have talked about some other things with that. That, you know, it's a nice practice because it lowers the amount of cells that are grown, so therefore lowers the amount of flavors they make that you may want to condition out. So fermenting under a little pressure is nice, or letting the temperature increase near the end of fermentation, because that'll help kick out some of those volatiles like sulfur and things that you might not want in the beer. And I think talking about temperature, that'll be a little tip I'll give there at the end, because when I talked about yeast, ale yeast 68, lager yeast 50-55 Fahrenheit. Remember that when we say ale yeast, we're talking about the clean ale strains. If you're using something wild, you're using something Belgium, let that temperature get above 68. Let it get into the 70s. It can even sometimes get in the 80s. These are wilder strains that need to finish out. They're going to need a higher temperature, and you're going to get a much more pleasant beer if you let that temperature increase. Otherwise, you're going to get stalled fermentations, kind of weird things going on. You know, let that temperature of those wilder strains ramp up. And, you know, again, they're going to make most of their flavor compounds in the first 72 hours. So especially after that or near the end of that, letting that temperature rise is a nice way to have a more interesting Belgian style or wild type of beer.
Well, Chris, I really appreciate you being here. I'd like to give you a minute here at the end to talk about any new projects you have going on at White Labs, or any new offerings you have.
Oh yeah, we've got a lot of projects. We got R&D, big, you know, nice R&D team here in San Diego looking at a lot of things, a lot of PCR right now. But then we've got innovation teams in all three of those facilities in San Diego, Asheville, and Copenhagen, Denmark, that are working on a lot of cool projects and cool new yeast strains. So we're really trying to use our different regions and harness their innovation talents, because there's different universities and breweries and all things in those areas. So the one thing we're coming out with at the end of the next couple of weeks, this month, is Kvike strain. We've been working with a few for a long time, some commercially, private strain wise, to different breweries, but a lot of people have been excited about this type of yeast for a while, that it's got a Saccharomyces cerevisiae, DNA with this high temperature DNA that allows you to brew close to that 90 degrees Fahrenheit, 30 C, and still make clean beers. So a lot of questions about it. We spent a lot of time really trying to optimize the right strain to come out with first. So that's what's exciting in the next.
I've heard about that. That's pretty interesting. I guess you can ferment it at close to 90 degrees Fahrenheit, right?
Yeah.
And it still comes out relatively clean, right?
Yeah. The one we're coming out with is phenolic negative. So you can have a high temperature phenolic negative, pretty cleanish beer. We're still calling it farmhouse, but that could even be debated.
But you don't even get a pile of esters, right?
No.
Pretty amazing. Well, Chris, I wanted to thank you again for coming on the show. Thanks for taking time to do this.
Well, thanks. And happy to do any more you like. These are a lot of fun for me.
Well, again,
I love talking to education, love homebrewing. And we've had these same conversations so many times over dinner, right? It's fun to do it on a podcast.
Yeah, I like drinking beer too, right?
Yeah.
It's always better over beer. Again, my guest today was Dr. Chris White, President, CEO, and founder of White Labs, as well as the author of the book Yeast. Thanks again, Chris.
Thank you.
A big thank you to Dr. Chris White for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're currently offering 20% off their All Access subscription pass, with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith and get your All Access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also Blickman Engineering, creators of the Riptide Pump. Designed for home brewers, this pump features a whisper quiet sealed housing, a removable tri-clamp stainless steel head that's easy to clean, and a built-in relief valve for easy priming. Get the Riptide Pump today, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And Beersmith 3 is available for download on both desktop and mobile platforms. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider support, new Whirlpool hop options, support for high-altitude brewing, and a whole lot more. Check out Beersmith 3 and get your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.